Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. If you have not signed up for Theology in the Raw's Exiles in Babylon conference yet, then you absolutely need to do so because space is filling up. That's March 31st through April 2nd here in Boise, or you can live stream the conference if you can't make it out here. But we're going to have loads of awesome fun here in Boise, Idaho, if you can make it out here, March 31st to April 2nd, or you can go to PrestonSprinkle.com and find out all about the Theology in the Raw Exiles in Babylon conference. Also, if you have benefited from the show, please do consider supporting it through patreon.com/theologyintheraw. Or if you can't afford to or just don't want to, please consider leaving a review. There's some pretty lame reviews on the podcast app, which are super entertaining. I love reading the one-star reviews. They're hilarious. But if you want to give it a higher review because you've benefited a bit from this show, then please do leave a review. Consider sharing this show on your social media outlets. My guest today is Dr. George Yancey. Dr. Yancey has a PhD in sociology from University of Texas at Austin. He is a professor of sociology at Baylor University. He has written lots of books, several on race and racism, and he has a forthcoming book called Beyond Racial Division, which you can pre-order now on Amazon, which you definitely will want to get a hold of, especially after you listen to this awesome conversation. So please welcome to the show the one and only Dr. George Yancey. Hey, friends, welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. I'm here with Dr. George Yancey. George, thanks so much for being on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we begin just by telling our audience just a little bit about who you are and what you do, and then I really want to get into your forthcoming book, Beyond Racial Division, because I can't wait to dig into that one, because I could probably, I have a sense of kind of what you're going to, where you're going to go in it, and I'm just really interested in what you're going to have to say. So yeah, tell us about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I work as a sociologist at Baylor University with the Institute for Studies of Religion. I've been there about 3 years now. I spent the 19 years before that at University of North Texas. So I've been in sociology. I've been writing about racial issues for quite a while. In fact, I took a little break from it for about 10 years until last year. So I've been dealing with this personally, as a Christian, intellectually, academically, for a good chunk of my life.
Okay.
And that's why I hope I can bring something different to the table than what a lot of other people are bringing.
What led you into sociology? Was that something that you feel like you've always been interested in, or?
No, not really. I didn't even, you know, they don't teach sociology in high school as a sociology course when I was growing up. Maybe they do now. They didn't. So I didn't know anything about sociology when I went to college. I took a couple of sociology, but I majored in economics. Okay. And it wasn't until grad school, when I was trying to get my master's in economics, I found out that I really didn't have that much more interest in economics. I took some other sociology courses that got me interested in sociology. And so it was an acquired taste, if you will.
And where'd you do your grad work at?
University of Texas.
Okay.
In Austin.
Hey, friends, I'm so sorry, but we had some audio problems over the next 10 to 12 minutes of our conversation. I didn't even realize it until we looked at the recording a week later. So our conversation was fluid and there were no glitches, but apparently there was some glitch with the audio for the next 10 or 12 minutes. We chit-chatted a bit about where he is teaching at Baylor University, about his denominational background. We talked about his book a bit. And then I asked him a question about active listening. He was talking about active listening, and I wanted him to tease that out a little more. So we're going to jump to that question, and the first few seconds of his response, those few seconds are gone, but I think you'll be able to get the gist of what he's talking about here. It's such an important thought that he has about active listening, so we're going to jump right into that question.
And we say listening to other people. Are you saying primarily people who maybe might not share the perspective you currently hold? I mean, just as a general statement, like getting outside of an echo chamber and just having genuine curiosity towards other.
That's fine that we have those people in our lives, but if that's all we listen to, And what research will say is if you don't have around people around you who disagree with you, you become more confident that you are right to the point that you cannot understand how other people can even think something differently. And then you can see where the conflict will come from that. If I think that, how can you even believe this thing that goes against my belief? Because everyone around me says that this is right. It must be right. And how can you? Therefore, you must not only be wrong, but there must be something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And right now, both sides are calling each other racist.
Yeah.
Because if you can't clearly see what I and all my friends see, something's wrong with you. You must be racist.
Yeah.
And of course, that gets us nowhere. That's where your defenses go up. That's where your people can no longer listen.
That's so common today, Joy. I mean, what you're describing is great, but I'm like, it's so rare I don't know. I feel like maybe some of the loudest voices are controlling the conversation. As I talk to just normal people, like you get off Twitter or whatever, and you talk to real people like your neighbor and stuff. I feel like there's a lot more. Yeah. Nuance. I don't know. Like, I feel like people are hungry.
It's hard to have this conversation on social media. Yes.
Yeah. I'm kind of darting around, but confirmation bias thing is huge, and especially in a day and age. I mean, even throwing COVID and all this stuff, and like views on vaccines and masks. Like, there's always somebody can find some study somewhere that supports their preconceived view, and then it makes it look like, oh no, I'm just following the science, whatever that means, but. It's like, I don't know. Like, it's like, as a scholar, as a fellow, I'm a biblical studies guy. And it'd be like somebody saying, well, biblical scholars say that. I'm like, stop there. there is no consensus on anything in biblical. Yeah. Well, scholars say that Genesis 3. Some say all kinds of things, like the idea that there's some sort of consensus among scholars. That doesn't really, I don't know. It's like we already have a view that we hold to, and there's probably complexities of why we hold to that. And then we'll just kind of grab hold of stuff that supports that, which is all the, which is everything you're saying. Sorry, I'm just repeating it, just getting outside of the echo chamber.
No.
I'm curious, what are your views on, so I read a wide diversity of stuff on the race conversation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll post pictures. I'm reading this. I'm reading Thomas Sowell. I'm reading Kindy, and people are like, yay and boo and yay and boo. And like, no, you should be saying yay of, we should read wide range of smart people on this. What's your perspective on the conversation / debate on, systemic racism versus personal agency? And I think that you already know probably what I'm saying there, so if you need me to explain more, obviously there's economic, there's very there's all kinds of disparities that still exist between majority white people and people of color, African Americans in particular, and there's lots of debates about why that is. Do you have a opinion?
Reality is so often so much more nuanced than we give it credit for. We think that, this is how we create heroes and villains and there's one cause of things and that sort of stuff. So is there systemic racism, discrimination? Mm-hmm. Yes, there's clear research on that. And it doesn't mean that everyone's a racist, obviously, but there's still institutions that have these centuries of abuse. It's left scars, and there's left scars in our institutions, and it impacts us. Is there human agency? Yes. I can give you examples of people of color who blame the man, and yet, they've not gotten off their behind in order to do what needs to get done. What whites have to do in order to succeed. And so before you can blame the man, you have to at least do the bare minimum of what other people are doing. Okay, so there's human agency as well.
Okay.
So reality is not as simple as saying it's only and always, institutional racism is only and always human agency. There's a mixture of all of that impacts the way race looks in our society. I think that is part of why the conversation is necessary, because some people focus so much on institutional racism, they sometimes don't see that, well, human agency matters too, and vice versa. They focus on human agency, they don't see how that matters. How much each matters in a given situation, I think, varies. I think there are situations where the institutional racism is so powerful, so overwhelming, that human agency is not that big of a deal, and vice versa. And so there's no one size fits all that we can just say it's 70% this and 30% that. But we need to have the conversation to get more say of nuance. And when we talk to people who differ from us in a way where we can hear them, they can hear us, I think we will gain more nuance in our understanding of what's happening in our society. I think that's lost in a polarized America too often. Yeah. And we don't understand the nuance of what's occurring around us.
Who are some people that in the race conversation that you would say are doing this well? Like, who are, if you could recommend a few people on besides yourself? Are there some leading thinkers that you really appreciated that are providing helpful nuance?
Yeah, you know, as far as leading thinkers, it's hard for me to think of people who are popular right now that I think are actually doing this.
Okay.
I know a book's coming out. Isaac Adams, I think is it Speaking of Race or Thinking of Speaking or Talking About Race, where he is a Christian minister who talks about how we can have this dialogue from a point of view as a minister. Mm-hmm. And he does an excellent job of holding all sides accountable for the dialogue, not for the outcome, for the dialogue. And so there's ideas like that. I really would like to see, I mean, there's Jarvis Williams. He has some really great stuff that he's coming out with. You know, of course I got to give a shout out to my boy, Michael Emerson, I've worked with him, and you know, his classic book, Divided by Faith, I think still is must reading for Christians, even though it's 20, 25 years old.
It's like it was written just a few years ago. Yeah. It's crazy.
But it's a classic. I hope that over time we can get a groundswell of thinkers who push this, because I think you're right. I think a lot of people really want this as opposed to the other two ideas. And I looked at this survey a while ago. It was on critical race theory. Mm-hmm. But it broke things down for me. And as I look at the results of that survey, I don't remember them exactly, but I came to the conclusion that it's probably about 15-20% of the people who are so wedded to colorblindness that they're not open to the conversation. Mm-hmm. About 15-20% of people are so wedded to this sort of activist anti-racism, they're not open to the conversation. But I think there's 60-70% of the population that, while they may favor one or the other, or maybe in the middle, they're open to something new. Mm-hmm. And I think they're open to, hey, can we have a real conversation in our society? So I think the majority really is there, but they're not the ones who get on Fox or MSNBC or CNN or PBS or anything like that.
I just listened to a fascinating podcast yesterday with an author. She's got a PhD from Berkeley. I'm blanking on the name. I can put it in the show notes, but the whole book was on how media outlets have just exacerbated the polarization. And she even talked about moving from like an ad-based revenue source for media outlets to subscription base. So now they're getting their funding from subscriptions, and the people that are going to subscribe are the ones that are going to pay money to hear what they want to hear. And it has just exacerbated this polarization. And then they know that certain emotions like anger and outrage, how could that person say that? I can't believe anybody who is so stupid. And both camps are doing this, you know, and subscriptions go up and they're all losing money. It blew me away. I mean, it blew me away in the sense that it kind of confirmed a lot of what I've already seen, but my confirmation bias, I guess. How much do you think, that media outlets have increased this kind of echo chambery polarization? Do you think that's a big part of the problem, or just a part?
I think it is a part of the problem. I have no doubt that's a part of the problem. That if you want to listen to certain views, you turn on to a certain media, and they deliver you what you asked for. I remember, I think it was not too long ago, that on MSNBC, their morning show, I think Morning Joe, had Ben Sasse on. And they had Ben Sasse on critiquing Trump. But Ben Sasse also, you know, said a few things, you know, because he's a Republican. And so he critiqued some things, you know, probably a little bit more gently. And from what I read, that the people on the show were outraged that Sass would dare to critique the Democrats because they turn on the Morning Joe. They turn on Morning Joe to get their daily fix of progressive politics. Likewise, when you turn on Fox and Friends in the morning, you're there to get a daily fix of conservative politics. We have a polarized society, and race is a big issue of that polarization, but it's by no means the only issue of that polarization.
Yeah.
And because we're so polarized, it makes the racial conversation worse. I'm still in the midst of thinking about how this really fits together in this sense. You know, we look at race and politics and religion, and they somehow just interact. So you get certain archetypes. So you get the white evangelical conservative, you know, political conservative. And then you get the Colin Kaepernick black activist. And I think that we create these archetypes in ways to allow us to more easily have enemies we can hate and heroes we can love.
Yeah.
And I think that that's part of why we're so polarized. And so the race is a part of that whole polarization piece. Part of my hope is that maybe if things that I say get caught on well enough, and even if we start just looking at this racially, then maybe we could pull a thread at the sort of process where a polarization that we're in, and maybe we can it can fall apart and we can say, hey, we can have differences of opinion, and I can think you're wrong about something, and that's fine, but that doesn't mean I have to dehumanize you. Because I fear too much in our society, the way that we talk about other people, we have to dehumanize them.
Right, right. Oh, man. Okay, you've mentioned in passing CRT, so I have to ask you your thoughts on CRT, because that I feel like that's just that that initials are polarizing, you know, and have been just we could use a lot more listening, I think, in that conversation. Give us your perspective on CRT and maybe explain what it is for those who think they know what it is.
I see CRT as sort of a placeholder for the argument on racial issues. Huh. And so, you know, what is CRT? Well, when I taught at University of North Texas, I taught undergraduate race and ethnicity. I taught my first graduate level race and ethnicity course, and then an upper division graduate level in race and ethnicity. Only in that upper division graduate level race and ethnicity did I discuss CRT. Because for me, it was something that I wanted students to have a certain amount of background before I jumped into something like that. And really, it wasn't that important of a theory. It was out there with other theories, but it wasn't like this dominant theory that was dominating everything. And now it's been made into this behemoth, this monster that, you know, that controls the conversation well beyond its influence.
Right.
Having said all that, so that's where I come from on that. I think that certain individuals use it to articulate an opposition to something that is CRT related, but not CRT proper. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a derivative of CRT, but it's not CRT proper. So what's happened is that everything becomes CRT. So let's say that you have D'Angelo taught in your school, and it's like, oh, that's CRT. Well, D'Angelo technically is not CRT, but you say CRT because that becomes the sort of the way to frame this, the way to signal that this is bad, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are those who say, well, CRT has no influence in our schools. And I find that a little disingenuous.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to say they're not teaching CRT in the schools. And I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's true. It's quite another to say there's no influence of CRT because even people like Kendi says he's a huge influence by critical race theory. So if you're going to teach the ideas of Kendi, you're going to teach the ideas that have been influenced by CRT.
Yeah.
So the other side has their ways of sort of massaging the issue. That's less than honest. But my druthers is that we just eject CRT out of this conversation altogether and directly discuss the issues at play. And so if you have a problem with white fragility being taught in your junior high, and I personally would, then discuss that.
Okay.
Don't say this is CRT, let's get it out. Discuss, here, here's why I think D'Angelo's wife fragility is not good to be taught to schools. And then focusing on that rather than say it's CRT and therefore we have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And just one last thing on CRT. I went to the Southern Baptist Convention last summer, and a lot of people had these stop CRT buttons walking around saying they're stop CRT. And they would go up and they would say, we can't have this taught in our schools because we got to stop CRT. I remember sitting next to my pastor going, Pastor, that's not CRT. and it's sort of like they're trying to search for a way to articulate what they don't like.
Yeah.
And it's just become this placeholder, and it's reached into the church as well as everywhere else. And so rather than people at the church discussing honestly problems they may or may not have, they just say, it's CRT, it's bad, let's get rid of it. Yeah. And it's just a sort of a weak way of thinking about how we're going to address these issues.
That, I mean, you articulated, and I've dabbled, okay? So I've read some original source material from critical race theorists, and I've read D'Angelo and Kendi and other people that seem kind of adjacent or at least influenced by or communicating some of the similar ideas but wouldn't be kind of critical race theorists. And I'm trying to put it, you exactly what you said is exactly what I've been thinking and haven't been able to articulate, that it's like a placeholder for maybe some bigger, broader racial perspectives that some people find troubling. On the flip side, you know, when I hear people, typically more progressive, say, well, none of this is CRT. You're talking about CRT, but this has nothing to do with it. I mean, that's not – let me read you a quote from Delgado in CRT, in Critical Race Theory in Introduction. He says, consider in how many disciplines scholars, teachers, and course profess almost incidentally to embrace critical race theory. Consider as well how many influential commentators, journalists, and books – such as Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, develop critical themes while hardly mentioning their origins in critical thought. Might critical race theory one day diffuse into the atmosphere like air so that we are hardly aware of it anymore? So that shows that there can be an influence of this highly academic, largely legal kind of theory that does diffuse, in the words of one of the main proponents, you know, diffuse into the air, so it does have an effect on
yeah.
other things. So that's kind of, it's exactly what you're saying. It's like, well, it's not,
right, yeah.
CRT is not the best name for all the stuff that people are, you know, opposing, whatever, discussing. At the same time, to say it's completely unrelated would be wrong as well.
I think it's fair. I mean, I think it's fair to say, look, you know, I think CRT is influencing some of the things happening in our schools. And I think that I think that's, you know, depending on what it is, I think that's kind of accurate. But the problem is, you know, why even go there? Why not just go directly to the thing that you don't like in the school?
Exactly.
Rather than say CRT impacted.
Right.
So I don't think CRT is this magical thing that, you know, if it's around, that it's just poison. Look. Do I have my difference with CRT? I do.
Sure.
Do I think that it also can bring some insight in certain ways? I do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not I think its influence has been overblown. I don't think it's this deadly thing, but I think it does. There are certain problems. I think that I find certain claims of it not well defended. Other claims.
Yeah.
Very insightful, just like a lot of different ways.
I've tried to get in the habit of just anytime a slogan or some big broad brush catchphrase is thrown at me, like, hey, what do you think about this? Mm-hmm. I'm like, my response is almost always ask me about a particular issue within, let's leave aside the slogan and let's ask me about a particular mm-hmm. issue that you think this thing's talking about. And I'll be honest. I mean, I'll probably say, you know, I don't know. I don't have enough expertise to have a strong opinion. Here's some thoughts I have, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think it's part of it's just laziness and that we are driven by fear. And it's much easier to have our tribe tell us, here's this bad thing.
Yeah.
And then we don't have to do the hard work of actually examining that. We just say, okay, that thing, bad. This sounds like that, bad. Bad tribe, bad, you know.
Yeah.
But it, again, it's right. just exacerbating that polarization, which hinders communication. What'd you think of D'Angelo's book? You mentioned her. Is it Beverly? No, Robin D'Angelo, White Fragility.
Robin, yes. Yeah. I'm not that impressed with her book. Her concept is not well defined. It's not something that you can really look at empirically. You have to ask questions. All right, why is fragility something unique to whites? If so, why? Why is it only whites would have this sort of fragility? She doesn't really answer that. There were some factual errors in the book. For example, she made a claim that all presidents between, I think it's 2016, you know, all these people are white, including the presidency. Well, of course, that's not true. In 2016, Obama was our president up until, I don't find it useful. She used very little research in that book. She used some stuff on implicit bias, but that's very questionable the way that she was using it. The idea that talking to whites and ultimately here's the big problem. The big problem is this. All right, so if you're a white person and you read White Fragility, what are you supposed to do? And according to D'Angelo, basically what you're supposed to do is shut up, listen to people of color, and do what they say.
Yeah.
Now, as an African American guy, yeah, that sounds great. listen to me, do what I say. I can live in that world. But I know, and research shows that is not going to be very effective. There's a certain percentage of whites who are going to feel a certain amount of guilt and are going to abide by it. There's another percentage of whites who are going to rebel by it. But there's this third group, which I think is very interesting, who understand that race is a problem. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to convince them that institutional racism is a problem. They understand that, and they want to do something about it. And they may even try to go this route for a while. I've talked to some who have. I said, I heard this, and I said, that's our role. But ultimately, being told to sit at the kids' table and not be able to have an input is something that they sense is wrong. Mm. They see problems. They cannot start to correct them. And they can't stay in that atmosphere. And honestly, I can't believe them. Yeah. I can't stay in an atmosphere like that where I have to shut up. And I'm not allowed to have an input in what's going to happen.
Right.
That, and to me, that is beyond the other problems. That is the big problem with white fragility. It does not provide a solution. It makes things worse.
Yeah. I've read a lot of stuff on various sides, and I just thought the book was just could have used some more editorial attention. Like it was just. And to me, I'm open to whatever. Maybe she's told. Maybe her conclusion's totally right. I mean, I wasn't really.
Yeah.
About that, it was more how she got there that just seemed really terribly argued and just poorly done. And it seemed to capture, like, you had this kind of like white progressives that, I think are, I don't know who's worse, kind of the radical right or the white progressive group, or whatever. But I think both of them have some serious issues. I'm reading a book, I'm like, this just exemplifies kind of like the almost the neocolonial air that I feel from white progressive. I mean, all the people hiring D'Angelo to come in and do the diversity trainings or whatever, like, are they people of color? Are they primarily like white progressives bringing her in? I don't know. Maybe I'm cynical.
Interesting. Yeah.
There was that study.
That would be interesting to find out. I don't know. She gave him a new book. She gave him a new book, Nice Racism.
No, I haven't seen it.
You haven't heard of the book?
Nice Racism?
Yeah, she gave a new book, Nice Racism. Yeah, which is interesting. I think the subtitle, and I don't remember, don't quote me word for word, is, how white progressives are making things worse.
Oh, good.
So she has her audience. She kind of has her audience. Her critique of white progressives is not your critique of white progressives.
Okay.
Trust me on this. Yeah. But she has her audience. And I guess, this book is aimed at that audience.
Okay.
And my guess is, culturally the most powerful people in this country are white progressives. A lot of white progressives own companies and are rich. And so, a book like that, she hits the right key. She could get called in and to speak in some more books. But I've not read this book, so I can't critique it.
Yeah.
I'm not eager to read it after having read My Fragility. So yeah. I'll see what
I liked Kendi's book better. I still have, you know, it comes from a very, very far progressive framework. I thought it was better. I thought I got a lot more out of Kendi's book. I still have, you know, questioned some. Again, I don't have enough knowledge base in the area to say I disagree, really. But it's some things I'm like, I'm not sure this is most helpful. Yeah. But I found his approach better. Yeah, there was that study that came out from one Yale professor on how it was so fast. I just read it this morning. Was it this morning or yesterday? About how white progressives, when they're speaking to people of color, they like dumb down their language. Did you see this?
I've heard that study. Yes,
And it wasn't. I mean, it was promoted by the Washington Post. It wasn't praising. They, you know, they basically said like white conservatives don't care enough to even try to build.
Yeah.
But the white progressives like dumb down their language. And it's like so like you think that's helpful? Anyway.
Yeah, I think white progressives would be an interesting group to study, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
Here's what I'll say about Kendi. You know, I have serious problems with Kendi's books as well. But Kendi he is more serious in ways that D'Angelo is not.
Okay.
I think he is more serious about his approach than yet. And maybe he feels freer to be more serious because he's an African American and she's white. I don't know.
Huh.
So in some ways, I mean, he's got this center at Boston University.
Yeah.
Get millions of dollars for it. I mean, he wants to make some real changes in society. Hmm. Now, I think some of his changes he wants to make are very problematic.
Yeah.
But I think that he's a more serious player in some ways than D'Angelo is.
Yeah. 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 What do you think about some of the they're not really – they're labeled as conservatives, but I don't think they all are. But some of the more black intellectuals like
McWhorter?
Yeah, John McWhorter or Glenn Lowry, Coleman Hughes, who's a young – I mean, but he's pretty brilliant.
Yeah.
Wilfred Riley, of course, Thomas Sowell and Shelby Steele and these guys. Are you familiar with them, and do you have – thoughts or warnings about them?
Yeah, I'm familiar with most of those. Riley, I've only seen one article from him, so other than that, I don't know that much about him. I think that they bring in their own perspective. It's kind of interesting. I mean, a lot of what they bring is what I would call more colorblindness to it.
Okay.
And yet, being an African American, when they do it, I have a lot of similar critiques when they do it, when them and whites do it. So I'm just
okay.
But when they do it, they almost you can see that they acknowledge a little bit more that there are racial problems, and but they still come back to the thing. The best thing to do is to ignore race. They acknowledge in a way that I don't always perceive when I hear certain whites talk about colorblindness.
Okay.
So I think it's a little bit different. Yeah, I would have to really do a close reading of them and some others to really articulate what I'm seeing. But I do feel that there's a difference there.
Sure. Okay.
Now, as I said, I critique both approach, both them and whites and the colorblindness, because I don't think it works.
Okay.
But I think there is a little bit of awareness. Yeah, you know, racism is a problem. A little more, we just think that this is the best way to do it. Whereas when I read some whites, if they talk about colorblindness, it's like racism is not a problem.
Can you – so people could probably guess, but for the few that maybe not know what exactly that means, when you speak of color blindness, in more negative, like this isn't a helpful –
it's the idea that the way to beat race is to ignore race. The way to beat racism is to ignore race. Don't treat anyone differently. Don't treat it differently, you know, on a personal level. Make sure the government doesn't treat anyone differently. You know, affirmative action is a problem because it treats people differently by race. Hate crimes, legislation is a problem for the same reason. Okay. Program should be color neutral. Maybe that's a better term, color neutral.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's helpful. Doesn't it come from a misunderstanding of that famous Martin Luther King quote, judge someone not by the color of the skin, but content of the
country? A lot of people like to use that quote, I know. Yeah.
Isn't that kind of, like,
I don't know if it comes from that. Okay. And that quote either put in the context of King's entire life.
Okay.
So King's entire life was not about color blindness. You know, you could take anyone, take a quote out of context and say, this is what this person represents.
Huh.
And King is fighting at a different time, too. And that's something – King was we are trying to deal with the history of racial abuse. King was dealing with racial abuse at that current point in time.
Sure.
And so I think that, you know, you have to be very careful to just rip this quote out of context and then say, okay, this is King's life calling. Mm-hmm. I think that people who do that are doing a disservice to King.
Yeah. No, that's good. Help us give us some distinctively Christian perspectives on the race conversation, because a lot of what we've been talking about is more kind of the broad race conversation in America. What are some things that Christians in particular should really make sure we don't lose sight of as we dive into this conversation?
Yeah, I've already mentioned one. I think the whole notion of human depravity is something. And it's easy for us to recognize it in others and hard for us to recognize it in ourselves. And so I think that we have to be very careful that we're open to human depravity in ourselves and listening to others. And that's kind of where I build on. Hmm. I also, though, would say that as Christians, we are charged to think of others and to put others before ourselves. And that aspect has to come to the racial conversation. That as I engage, I have to have in my mind, how am I going to engage in a way that is to the benefit of you or who I'm engaging with, and not just me. One of the things that I'd like to say is, you know, the big enemy of the Jews of that day was the Samaritans. And, you know, you're a Bible teacher, so I'd have to tell you that the Samaritans, there's a history there. Yeah. The Samaritans were half-breeds in the way that we would think about today. You know? So in some ways, that is, while it's not a perfect parallel, it's a good parallel to think about racial issues. So how did the Bible treat the Samaritans in the New Testament? You know, the woman at the well.
Yeah.
You know, the story of the Good Samaritan. Okay, going to do what likewise.
Yeah.
You go in our society and find the Samaritans for you, and you do likewise. Hmm. You treat them with human dignity as Jesus did with the woman at the well. Hmm. You actually see them as having something to offer, as Jesus did in the well, and you care about what they're doing. You see them as the Good Samaritan, you know, someone, if they're wounded, you take care of them as a Good Samaritan, took care of his ideological, ethical, ethnical enemy. You treat them in that way, paying the hotel manager, and I'll take up you sacrifice for people you think of as your enemy. That is a hard road to hoe for anybody.
Yeah.
But that's what I think we're called to do as Christians.
Yeah,
and, you know, I want to articulate a way in which we could try to do that.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. Can you speak, just in the couple minutes we have left, directly to my white Christian audience who is asking? I know we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but they're like, hey, I don't like racism. I'm not sure what's going on. I hated what happened to George Floyd. I hate this polarization. What can we all do to help and further the race conversation?
Yes. So, you know, for whites, as far as this racial conversation, it's a very difficult one. And I understand where whites come from, is that they don't want to be accused of being a racist.
Right.
And they don't want to accuse of anything they say is a racist. And I will be the first one to say that some of what some people of color do to whites is unfair. Mm-hmm. Some of the microaggression type stuff, you know, it's not well based. So some of it's unfair. So what do? Do you take that fear and then get back on a racial conversation? Well, there's a story once I was told of a bird. And this bird was flying around, and some boys threw some rocks at it and wounded the bird and fell down. And the boys were coming around, they're sticking at the bird, you know, they're just little boys, this is what they do. Mm-hmm. And this girl's like, oh no, stop doing that. And she was like, get on the boys to get them to stop. So finally the boys got tired of messing the bird and stopped. So the bird was gonna lovingly go and pick up the bird. The bird saw the girl and bit the girl. Why the bird bite the girl? The bird bit the girl because it experienced with kids to that point had been to throw rocks at it and to stick it. And so when the girl came at the bird with love, its reaction was to strike back. Sometimes people of color strike back. It is not always fair. It is, however, understandable. As white Christians, your call is to love through that. Now, Are there people who are unreachable that you have to sometimes let go? Yes, there are. But the best we can do is to love people through that. Understand why the pain may be there. Listen to the pain. Mm-hmm. Listen, sometimes people just need to vent their pain. They're not looking for solutions. Mm-hmm. When they want solutions, that's when the mutual conversation has to occur. But sometimes all people need is someone who's there to understand that they're in pain.
Yeah.
Listen to that. And then as things open up, I would also say to whites, when you reach out to people of color, don't reach out in a way to where you're maintaining control. What I mean by that is if there's a black congregation, don't go to the black congregation and say, hey, we have the answers. Here's what you need to do. Find out what that black congregation is doing and you support them in what they're doing. And then develop those relationships. So over time, it's going to be mutual. So I'm a big believer in mutual relationships, but I also know that the way it's developed, we're going to have to work towards that at times.
Yeah.
It's not going to just happen over, just instantly. Hey, we're equal, and we just have this easy conversation.
Yeah.
Understand where the pain comes from, and then be ready to deal with that.
The book is Beyond Racial Division. You can go pre-order it now. I'm going to go pre-order it now. Or maybe I'll ask your publisher to send me a copy because I do want to save me a few bucks. But
sure.
George, thank you so much. Man, I so enjoyed this conversation. And I just love your perspective. I love your humility and just your emphasis on that kind of active listening and being genuinely curious. If we can all do that, I think the world would be a better place. So thank you so much for this. This is a super helpful conversation. Really appreciate you.
Thank you, and God bless.
Take care. Hey, friends, if you've been blessed, challenged, encouraged, or angered by this podcast, would you consider supporting it through Patreon.com? That's patreon.com/theologyintheraw. All the info is in the show notes. You can support the show for as little as $5 a month and get access to Q&A podcasts, monthly Patreon-only blogs, and basically just get access to the community and help support this ministry that we're doing at Theology in the Raw. Again, check out the show notes and consider supporting this show.